This meeting of the House Judiciary Committee will now come to order. The time is now 1:01 p.m. on Wednesday, February 4th, 2026. We are meeting in the Grunberg Room, Capitol Room 120. The following members are present: Representative Underwood, Representative Eichheit, Representative Vance, Representative Mina, and Vice Chair Kopp, and myself, Representative Gray, Chair. Let the record reflect that we have a quorum to conduct business. I would like to recognize the staff supporting this meeting: Sophia Tenney from House Records, Kyla Tupo from the Juno LIO, and my staff, Dylan Hitchcock Lopez. We have three items of business on today's agenda. The first will be the consideration of nominees to the Select Committee on Legislative Ethics: Deborah Fancher, public member, and Chase Berenson, public member alternate. We will also hear the introduction of House Bill 262, Number of Superior Court Judges, presented by Nancy Mead, counsel to the judiciary of the court system. Thank you. And then we will hear our second hearing of House Bill 20, Prohibit Fees for Paper Documents, presented by Representative Sadler and his staff, Kai Elkins. We will now begin our consideration of nominees to the Select Committee on Legislative Ethics. We will begin with Deborah Fancher. At this time, I invite her to take herself off mute, state her name for the record, and provide a brief introduction. Deborah, if you're there. Oh, unavailable. We are moving to Chase Berenson. Mr. Berenson, if you could take yourself off mute, state your name for the record, and provide a brief introduction and any remarks you would like to share with the committee, you can do so now.
Good afternoon, Chair Gray. Thank you for the opportunity. This is Chase Berenson speaking to you today from Anchorage. I have always felt it's important to serve my community. I live in Girdwood, and I serve on multiple methods in Girdwood. And I think it's an incredible opportunity to try to serve the state at large. And I think this is a great opportunity to work with the legislator and the Ethics Committee to allow us to maintain public trust in the legislature and make sure things continue rolling smoothly. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Mr. Berenson. Are there any questions from the committee? Representative Mina.
Thank you, Chair Gray. Through the chair, thank you for putting your forth your name for this committee. What is your interest on the Ethics Committee?
Thank you, through the chair, to Representative Mina. I think it's important for, you know, the state, the population of the state, to be able to have faith and trust in the legislature. And I also think it's important for the legislature to have faith and trust in the system. So I think it's an important committee. I don't get on with a specific angle or specific drive for the committee, but I think it's important to serve.
Thank you.
Any other questions from the committee for Mr. Berenson? Mr. Berenson, could you speak to any specific qualifications that you might have that you'd bring to the table while serving on the Ethics Committee?
Yes, thank you, to the chair. I have I've been working for years in business leadership roles, mostly in Alaska Native corporations and in rural parts of the state. And, you know, when you're working in that environment, you're working in an area where people are looking up to you and with trust, and you have to make ethical decisions. You know, you've got a variety of stakeholders, and everyone, you know, has different views, different needs, and you're trying to work through and manage all of those tasks and do them impartially while also serving a variety of stakeholders in the business. So I think that, you know, it helps me to come in and approach this to say, you know, you need ethical clarity, you need the transparency, you need the sound judgment, and you need to be impartial in what you're doing.
Thank you. Any other questions? Seeing no other questions, we will now open up public testimony on the appointment of Chase Berenson. Public testimony is now open. Is there anyone in the room that would like to testify on the appointment of Chase Berenson? Seeing no one in the room, we will look online. Is there anyone online? Seeing no one online, public testimony on the appointment of Chase Berenson is now closed. Mr. Berenson, thank you so much for your time and your willingness to serve. We are going to move back to Deborah Fancher. I believe she is available now. Ms. Fancher, I hope I'm saying your name correctly. Can you please take yourself off mute, put yourself on the record, and offer any opening comments that you would like to give?
Hello, Representative Gray and members of the committee from sunny 80 degree Mexico. My name is Deb Fancher. I have been on the committee. This will be my second reappointment, if that does happen. I grew up in rural Alaska. Other than 5 years at the university, I have lived in Alaska my whole life. I was a teacher in Anchorage for almost 25 years, and I continue to teach in Anchorage on a part-time basis. I am absolutely not qualified for the role on the Ethics Committee. I don't have any legal training, but when I was appointed by the Supreme Court Justice, one of the things that he said is, being a science teacher, you try to look at things analytically, and I believe that I tried to do that. So that is, you know, pretty much my background. I've always encouraged my students to be involved. I never thought I'd see myself on the Ethics Committee, but I would always like to think that I would be involved and practice what I preached. And so here I am volunteering on the Ethics Committee so far. I've learned a ton, kind of like drinking from a fire hydrant. And I really feel like, you know, you're just kind of getting up and started, because there's a lot to the code and times have really changed. So there you are.
Thank you so much. And thanks for calling in from Mexico. Are there any questions from the committee for Ms. Fancher? Representative Eichheit.
Thank you, Chair Gray. And through the chair, Ms. Fancher, thank you for putting your name in. I listened quite closely to you saying you're a former science teacher and you'd be analytical. I also am a former science teacher, and so I'm sure we both have some knowledge of how you evaluate data in the science realm. Do you have any kind of guiding rubric or thing in mind that you would use to evaluate ethics in this role?
You know, it's interesting. In my classroom, I always said we need to be firm and we need to be fair. And I think in ethics, it's no different. You need to be firm, you need to be fair, and I would add you need to be consistent. So the same things that you use when you're running a good classroom, you use when you're working on an ethics decision. Firm, fair, consistent. How would I want my kid to be treated? How would I want to be treated? I don't think it matters whether you have an R, a D, an I, or anything else by your name. What has guided me in my classroom reasonably successfully is the firm, fair, consistent.
Thank you. Any other questions from the committee? Representative Mina.
Thank you, Chair Gray. Through the chair, thank you, Ms. Fancher, for putting your name in again and for your honesty about coming into the Ethics Committee with not much background in the law. But, you know, I think there's so much value in having public members and everyday Alaskans serving on these committees. So since this is a reappointment, what have you learned during your time on the Ethics Committee?
That adults behave much like high school students. I'm probably not supposed to say that. I've learned a ton. I've learned a lot about the Ethics Act. I also think that our times have changed and that we really need to, I think having an ethics committee is very important. Why do I think it's important? I think it's important because what I've learned is there are a lot of things that are out there that are not covered. Social media, AI, those kind of things are huge. And that's why the role that you play on the ethics committee is always changing. But going back to earlier, not to beat a dead horse, but firm, fair, consistent, that doesn't change. And I think that, you know, I've learned a lot continuously. Basically, we need to have some modifications to the Ethics Act to kind of fit with the times. But I think everybody knows what good honest government looks like, and we all want that. And one thing I have learned, I've learned how much I admire some people, and not to name drop, but I'm going to name drop anyway. Senator Stevens. I mean, Senator Stevens is just, I never knew him before I was in this role. I believe Senator Stevens loves Alaska with everything that's inside him. And I really, really appreciate people that I've served with on the committee, that especially the representatives, senators and representatives, they really love Alaska. And I appreciate that. As an Alaskan, somebody that loves Alaska and lived there my whole life and I'll die there, I love Alaska. And I want good people representing me, and I've appreciated that.
Thank you. Any other questions for Ms. Fancher? Seeing no more questions from the committee at this time, we will now open it for public testimony. Public testimony on the appointment of Deb Fancher is now open. Is there anyone in the room who would like to testify? Seeing no one in the room, we'll look online. No one online? Seeing no one online, public testimony on Deb Fancher is now closed. Ms. Fancher, thank you so much for your time and willingness to serve. At this time...
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Do you take committee comments?
Sure. Committee comments. We are open.
Yeah. I'd just like to say I've known Ms. Fancher and her brothers since high school, and she's a solid person. Amazing, in fact, but... Yeah, originally Deb Berge, and I came out of the Berge family out of Glen Ellen, and they're, yeah, just amazing family, very ethical, very sound people, and incredibly hardworking. She's absolutely brilliant. I just wanted to say as a committee member, I'm proud to support her.
Thank you, Vice Chair Kopp. In accordance with AS 24.60.131, the judiciary held a hearing on the following appointees to the Select Committee on Legislative Ethics: Deborah Fancher, public member; Chase Berenson, public member alternate. We will distribute the paperwork at this time. Signature on this report does not reflect an intent by any of the members to vote for or against ratification of the individual or individuals during any further session. At ease. An item of business will be to take up House Bill 262, number of Superior Court Justice, number of Superior Court Judges, for its first hearing in our committee. At this time, I would like to invite Nancy Mee, General Counsel for the Alaska Court System, up to introduce the bill.
Thank you very much, Chair Gray and members of the committee. My name is Nancy Mead, General Counsel for the Alaska Court System. House Bill 262 would add an additional Superior Court judge. That judge would sit in the 3rd Judicial District, and specifically we're seeking this judge because we have a need in Palmer. So that is where this new judge would be serving. For procedural context, House Bill 262 was introduced by rules at request, and the request was made by the Supreme Court. And that's why I am in the role of providing information as the sponsor, more or less, of this bill. This is unusual. The court system does not seek statutory changes very often because statutes are generally policy issues that are left to this branch of government. But the statutes do set the number of judges. So instead of adding a judge through a budgetary request, as one might expect when you want to add a position to your entity, agency, or department, or branch, we need to have authorization from this body in order to change that statute. So it is not a budget request. It is a bill with a fiscal note. This bill would do specifically is amend Alaska Statute 2210-120, which does set the number of Superior Court judges. And as you can see, it currently says there are 45 judges. We would seek to make that 46. And then very simply on line 7, it says 28 are in the 3rd District, and we would hope to change that to 29. So that's the the way that this would be effectuated for the court system. And I'm going to talk a little bit about why the Supreme Court made the decision to ask you for this and address some of the alternative ways we've been trying to address the issues in the Palmer Courthouse. One bit of background, and members of this committee may be very familiar with that, though, the Superior Court is the court of general jurisdiction. It's the trial court of general jurisdiction. They have authority to handle anything, and then a subset of their jurisdiction is delegated to district court judges. But the Superior Court can do all trial court matters. What they work on, and so this is the judge that you would be providing, is felonies, domestic relations, which is child custody, divorce, dissolution, paternity, probate matters, mental commitments, protective proceedings like guardianships and conservatorships, and wills, of course, child in need of aid cases, our neglected child cases, civil cases with an amount in controversy over 100,000, and juvenile delinquency cases. So lesser cases, for example, misdemeanors as opposed to felonies, go to the district court. So we are not directly affecting those cases, though, as you'll see from my descriptions later, indirectly in some ways. So minor offenses, evictions, small claims, they go to district court. But we're talking here about the Superior Court cases. To give you a little bit more context, so you can picture what we're looking at. There are currently four Superior Court judges in Palmer. The filings in the Palmer Superior Court fluctuate over the years, as one might expect. It just depends on what people, what their issues are and what they need to bring to court. But over the past 5 years, they've been between 2,650 and 2,950. In my mind, I think about 2,800 cases a year on average. So they're important cases and they're affecting, well, maybe about 2,800 Alaskans per year. And actually, cases often have two parties. So it's an awful lot of people. One more bit of context, the Palmer Court has, close to the same division of case filings as the rest of the state. But interestingly, their biggest Superior Court, their biggest case type is probate cases. They have about 30% of their filings are probate cases. An awful lot of those are mental commitments. Not too long ago, somewhere in the Mat-Su, a new mental health facility opened up, and that led to an increase in the filings in that court for those Alaskans experiencing mental health issues that require judicial intervention. So 30% of their cases are probate cases, and about 25% are felonies. And I know people think that's mostly what the court does, but we do an awful lot. They have a little somewhat fewer than the case average of felonies, and they have about a little higher than the case average for domestic relations, another 20% of their caseload. The rest are those child in need of aid, civil, and other case types. So this judge that we're seeking would do all the Superior Court case types. In Palmer, the judges generally, with a few exceptions, handle all the case types that come in the door. They just get divided up there. So why do we need another judge in Palmer? The very short answer, though by no means the whole story, is that they just carry the largest caseloads in the state, and they are struggling with those large caseloads. So what I mean is, if you take those case filings and divide them by four to get the per judge number, what they had in fiscal year 25 was 683 cases per judge. The statewide average is 458. So they exceeded it by another third or so. They exceeded the average by that much. The next busiest court is Anchorage. Anchorage has 544 cases per judge. So they are extremely busy themselves. And by the way, if you authorize this fifth judge for Palmer, they would still have the highest or second highest caseload in the state of Alaska. And and would be well above the state average. And this isn't new. Palmer has had the highest caseload for at least the last six fiscal years. So this is something that the court has been dealing with and struggling with. A couple of years there, they had over 700 cases per judge, 740 one year. And of course, they've always had the same four judges, but that's due to the fluctuation in the case filings. And it might be obvious, but the problem with having the highest caseload in the state is that the justice that is served is not what we would like to see. We want to be able to meet people's needs, and the level of service can fall below what we find acceptable when the court is that swamped. So that's what we're trying to address. As the committee is also aware from other bill presentations and other things, the Matanuska-Susitna Valley is the biggest, the fastest growing population in the state. The last time the Palmer Court got new Superior Court judges was in 2007. So if you compare case filings in 2006, which is the year that they had data that authorized that bill, to the filings in 2025, they've increased about 56% since that time. So they've been doing with those same resources with 56% more cases. And the Department of Labor estimated the population for Palmer, the Matsu Valley, I should say, in 2006 compared to the population now, well, that has increased by about 58%, so quite in line with the increase in filing. So it stands to reason that that increase in population leads to increased use of state resources, including the judicial resources. And as you know, the population of the Matsu is predicted to grow. The Department of Labor estimate I saw on the website was that it would grow another 20% in the next 20 years. Other sources that I just found on the internet said that that was low and it could be more. But in any case, if you go with 20%, you can see that the need is there to address this population. So having those highest caseloads is a key aspect of the problem with dispensing justice in Palmer. And those are the numbers that are really driving this request. But it's not even the whole picture. Not only have those case filings grown, but cases have changed in the 20 years since we last received Superior Court judges. Cases have become far more complex. That's due to technology. And when you have evidence that is phone dumps or computer hard drive reads, or you have DNA, or if you have other scientific evidence, it leads to cases just taking longer to process. And it might be because expert witnesses in these areas might have litigation as to their qualifications. It might be that the level of detail that needs to be discussed in the court or through discovery motions or something else is far more than it was 20 years ago. So cases just take longer to analyze. Another way cases have become more complex is because victims' rights in felony cases have been expanded, and that's a wonderful thing. It does take longer for a court to deal with another bit of information that they need to weigh in their decision making. Victims have a right to speak, so that is something that has to occur. Sometimes hearings have to be put off if a witness is unavailable or was not able to be contacted about a hearing. So it's just more to balance and consider for the judge in their decision making. In child in need of aid cases, the practice of using one family, one judge, was codified in 2017. It's the best practice of having a family who might be involved in, for example, a custody case, and somebody in that family also is filing a domestic violence protective order. There might be children in need of aid. There might be a delinquency. All of that now goes to the same judge. This is better so that the family doesn't feel shuffled around. That judge might gain knowledge of the dynamics of the family that might aid in decision making. It's a great practice, but it means that pieces of cases cannot be delegated to, for example, the district court can't handle the domestic violence protective order. It's all conglomerated the same, and that leads to more work for Superior Court judges. There are more VCORs, those are violating conditions of release in felony cases. And that's because this this body authorized a new state entity within the Department of Corrections to supervise people who are out on bail pending trial. Those people are now, not always, but can be told that their one of their bail conditions is to be supervised. When you're supervised, you might get caught a little bit more than you were previously. That has led to an increase in those VCOR charges. That's not reflected in case filings because they're not a new case. They're an additional charge in a case, but they do create additional workload for the judge. My final example of case processing practices that have changed is the growing number of self-represented litigants. This is not only in Palmer, statewide certainly. In the way it affects Superior Court cases the most is in domestic relations cases. Over 70% of those cases have at least one party that is representing themselves. And this is great so people can have access to justice even when they may not have the means to pay an attorney or there are not enough pro bono attorneys or to assist. But it's very impactful on the court's case workload. And that's because when people represent themselves, they may file more frequent motions. They might want to present arguments that are actually unrelated to the relevant legal issues. They might not know to submit the necessary information for calculating child support or property division. And they may not fully explain the legal bases for their positions or the arguments that they want to present. They're important, and we are committed to, you know, providing everybody access to justice, but the judge needs to work harder to figure out what is really going on with those cases in many situations. And in those cases, there's often a lack of communication between the parties, so they're unable to, say, stipulate to something or come to agreement when because they are the people involved in the emotional issues. I want to let you know of the steps we've taken to try to address the problem short of coming to you and asking for an additional judge. The main thing we've tried is temporary reassignments of judges to cover part of the caseload in Palmer. Naturally, those temporary reassignments would be coming from Anchorage judges. And so we've had success with that. Anchorage, as I mentioned, is the second busiest court, and they really do not have a lot of capacity to do this. But if an Anchorage judge decides to help out Palmer for a month or for 1 3-week trial or something, well, their cases keep coming and it languishes back in Anchorage. So this problem in Palmer is actually causing a ripple effect throughout the system. We have had the Valdez judge handle some of the child in need of aid cases. Well, now we're talking travel time, a day on either end to get to Palmer. So some of that was handled remotely. The remote child in need of aid proceedings can be difficult. There are a lot of parties involved. So we did that for a while. But then again, that judge also handles Cordova and Glen Allen. She just had a 4-week homicide case in Glen Allen. And basically, that causes a ripple there. So we did it where we could. The presiding judge himself, who sits in Anchorage, went to Palmer for 2 very big cases to try to help out and, you know, did in fact help out. My understanding is that at every judge meeting in Anchorage, the presiding judge says, who can help in Palmer? Who had maybe a cancellation of something or something come off their calendar and can give a week or a month or fill in for one trial? And that has worked a bit. But it is not terribly sustainable as a way to fix this problem. One of the issues with doing that is that the Palmer Courthouse doesn't have an extra courtroom. So when somebody goes up, there's juggling that needs to happen, and they can't always be as efficient. They need a courtroom to get some of this work done. And there aren't any extra offices. So that Anchorage judge might, you know, be sitting in a library with his or her own computer. So it's we've managed with some of these fixes, but it is not the best way to do it. Some of those Anchorage judges who don't want to drive to Palmer every day have sought to have cases moved, have the venue changed to Anchorage. And that's a good way to handle it. And we're trying to do that more. But the parties, especially if there's a jury trial, they have a right to have their case heard in their home court. And so they would have to consent. Some of them are consenting, but not always. And that, you know, you have to ask whether they should have to. But that's what we're trying. So it's a little bit like robbing Peter to pay Paul. We're covering, but not very well. Another thing we've tried is to take the sitting district court judges in Palmer. So there are three of those. And what we call pro tem them up, give them a temporary assignment authorizing them to have jurisdiction over the superior court cases. That is authorized by court rule if the Chief Justice makes the appointment through the presiding judge. But the Palmer District Court also is busy. They have about the average number as the rest of the state of cases per judge. And if you take one away, the other two then have way above the average because there's only the few judges left. So they've done that for a time period. And then we took a district judge from Anchorage and sent them to Palmer to cover that. But as you can see, it's been a patchwork. Our main goal with all the patchwork is to address the cases that have definite timelines, the criminal cases and the child in need of aid cases in particular. And we've been fairly successful at doing that. We've sent the judges up to cover those, and it's worked all right. The rest of the cases, though, are really languishing, and that's not a good way to do business. The third way we've addressed this is through the use of pro tem judges. You've heard me talk about that before. Retired judges can volunteer to be on a list to come back and help in certain cases. They have a choice. This is also authorized by rule. And so they'll get a call. Will you sit for a month in Palmer, or will you come up just for this two-week sex assault trial so that the assigned judge can continue his other work? And there are different arrangements. And yes, sometimes that works. And again, we've done it, we continue to do it, but it is, it's just not the best solution. And those judges do get paid, and we aren't funded to keep, you know, basically a permanent pro tem judge up in Palmer. So we're trying, and you can see that it has a domino effect on the other courts, and Anchorage isn't feeling the effects. The enthusiasm to volunteer for these temporary assignments is waning, and we're hoping to have a better solution. And so I also want to stress, because of those things that we've been having to do, that this is not a regional issue. The Palmer Court is called the Palmer Court, but it's really the Mat-Su Court. It serves Wasilla, of course, and Houston, Kinnick, Talkeetna, the entire Matanuska-Susitna Valley. And then, as you can see, that's not all that happens when you're short a judge. You're affecting the Anchorage Courthouse as well, the Valdez Courthouse, and others. And when you use your pro tem judges to sit in Palmer, that means that individual is not available to take a case in Bethel or a case in Fairbanks. So this is what we're trying to address. That's the main points that I was hoping to make, and I'm happy to answer any questions that the committee may have.
Representative Vance.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a series of questions, so permission to dialogue with Ms. Mead.
Permission granted.
Thank you. Good afternoon. It's the first that we've seen each other this year.
Nice to see you.
And I am so pleased to see this piece of legislation, because we know the need has been talked about for many years. So to help us better understand, you know, the difference between the district judges, the superior court judges, have you, first of all, do you need statutory authority to increase the number of district judges? And will that help with the overall caseload? Because I'm looking at these numbers, and you mentioned that there's a projection of a 20% increase in the area. You know, why not have an additional judge at this request. I know the courts are always very prudent in their fiscal requests, which I appreciate, but we know that one of the main concerns is the timeliness of justice in the system. So can you help us understand how the courts came to the decision of, at this time, asking for one superior court judge, excuse me, and the impact that has on the district judges?
Through the chair to Representative Vance, the number of district court judges is set in statutes, yet there is a subsection C that says the Supreme Court can increase or change these numbers by rule. And so, no, we do not need to go to the legislature to change the number of district court judges. And there is a rule that sets those. So we would be able to add one by rule and then have a normal budget request for the money. Your second part is why request sort of just one judge when there could be evidence of more need. The reason is twofold. First is the reluctance, I guess, to ask for too much in times of fiscal austerity. We're hoping that this will help address the problem and it will be a big improvement for the court. But another reason is we don't have space for more judges. As you know, this is a big ask from the court over the last couple of years for capital money to build out that Palmer Courthouse to add three more courtrooms and, in addition, a shell so we could add yet more courtrooms in the future. That request was not successful, and the thinking there was we would get those courtrooms and then be able to fill them with judges. That was not successful, but we did get 2 years ago phase one, and we received some funding. That has not all been expended. That is the money for this that we can create one courtroom out of. So that's why we're asking for that now. So our plan for facilities is to use some of that money that we've already been given, so there's no capital request with this bill, to take some space that was recently vacated in the basement of the Palmer Courthouse, which houses the agencies as well. It was vacated by one of the executive branch agencies, and we would take that, do some remodeling and moving, and turn that into a grand jury courtroom, thus freeing up space upstairs where we could build a courtroom for this judge, and a judge comes with three staff, and build those accompanying offices. So without capital funding, we can only accommodate one additional judge in Palmer. I will also say, though, in recognition of your point that it's growing and growing, that I suspect I'll be back here in future years, not too far in the future, asking for resources, whether in Palmer or Anchorage or elsewhere.
Well, thank you. You answered several follow-up questions all in one, which I greatly appreciate. With the last statement of coming back, you know, requesting for more, do the courts have a timed review looking at the caseload and the need for judges that say every 5 years, 10 years that you just automatically look at that? Or is it kind of, oh my goodness, we're feeling overwhelmed? Is there any process that is on a timed regular basis that the court looks at this?
Through the chair to Representative Vance, yes and no. They look at it all the time. So there isn't, it's not a periodic review, but there are meetings between administrators and the Supreme Court justices. You know, the Supreme Court ultimately makes the decisions, explaining trends, case filing trends, workload trends, you know, the atmosphere in different courthouses The Chief Justice is, of course, the chief administrator of the whole court system's branch, but the all of the Supreme Court is made aware of budget issues, case issues, you know, who might be, you know, experiencing difficulties. So it's on an ongoing basis that they look at these things.
I have one more follow-up, Mr. Chair, and then I'll hand it over to someone else. Would love to help you out with the facility, but I will leave that for a separate discussion. Has the courts looked at the cost of increasing the judges versus the cost to the corrections? Because we have, you know, so many cases where people are awaiting trial, and that is kind of a lack of justice on their part, and therefore the cost to house them in the court system, in corrections, is implied, and you continually have to make those extensions and make space. Has there ever been within the state or within the courts, you know, a look at the cost benefit ratio of the timeliness of and number of judges?
Through the chair to Representative Vance. It's a quite complex question, and I'll try to give a simple answer that that is satisfactory, but stop me if I'm not addressing your issue. I completely understand that the cost of housing people pre-trial is partially, at least, due to cases taking longer than they might otherwise. The cases take longer than they might otherwise for lots of reasons other than not having a judge. Cases take long because, largely because parties, the agencies, ask for more time and the judge needs to grant it or determines that it's warranted. So it's a whole system-wide issue that causes people to have long pretrial time periods. And so offsetting, you know, the cost of pretrial versus the price of a judge would not be the appropriate comparison without the cost of attorneys and the public defenders and at the prosecutor's office. So there would be a lot that played into it. The cost of moving cases faster would be many, many, many dollars because it would be providing additional resources to many people besides the court in order to make an impact on the speed of those cases. I would also add, and this is no solace to certain individuals who are being held pretrial, that when and if they get sentenced, the time they spent and therefore the money spent on them in pretrial status is credited against their sentence. So if you are in pretrial and you are incarcerated pretrial for 1 year, and at your trial, the ultimate sentence is 2 years in jail, you get credit for that year. So fiscally only, it's not wasted money, if you see what I'm saying. Otherwise, you would be paying after the sentence. And again, that is totally discounting the human cost. And then, of course, many people who go to trial or have their cases resolved are not held in jail pre-trial, so that would not play into it. But I hope that was a bit of a picture that responded.
It was. Thank okay. you. And it reminded me of many other variables, but I appreciate that. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thanks, Representative Kopp.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Ms. Mead. I'm sure you wouldn't be here unless you needed another judge. I remember in 2018, I think we did that for Juneau here. We actually reclassified a position. Question I have, you mentioned the austere fiscal times, and you are correct. So we have a fully loaded cost of over $1 million here for this position, which is not inconsequential. So I'm looking at the Palmer Courthouse. Because we're not just hiring the judge, we're hiring the whole support staff. I see there's three more positions. Is there, and I don't know about the room for all this in the Palmer Courthouse either, if we can just put four more people in there full-time or not. Is there room? First question. And second, is there any possibility for a judge to share a judicial assistant, a judicial law clerk, or an in-court clerk? I know it's written up in a way that permanently assigns those three to the one judge. And so those are my initial thoughts. And can we expect a fiscal note from the Department of Law? I saw the public defender jumped on there with a fiscal note reflecting if we have more capacity to move cases, there's going to be more representation. So they have a fully loaded attorney cost thrown in there. And I didn't know if you'd heard any rumblings that law is going to put another prosecutor in there or not.
Through the chair to Representative Kopp, I heard a couple of questions. So first of all, our fiscal note does include four positions because a judge does come with a judicial assistant, a law clerk to do research, and an in-court clerk to handle recordings and paperwork inside the courtroom. every Superior Court judge has that staff. It would be not just unusual, but difficult for a judge to function without that staff. It might be like saying to you guys to share staff. You develop a relationship. There are needs. The judicial assistants are very busy, and the law clerk is very, I mean, they're all busy positions. Sharing an in-court doesn't work if two people have a hearing at the same time, and that happens constantly, really. When we, in the past, did change a Juneau district court judge into a Superior Court judge, which is what you're recalling, Representative, we thought that that could be done without a law clerk, and we did not ask for funding for a law clerk, thinking that they could share. That did not succeed. We ultimately had to get a law clerk for that judge because that one law clerk could not fulfill the needs of both judges. So it didn't work out, and it's something that we would be not too pleased to try again, having the experience that it just doesn't work. So every Superior Court judge does need to have those resources in order to be effective. I cannot speak at all to the executive branch's plans for fiscal note, so I won't touch that. And then your third issue had to do with the room for it. But
space, yeah.
Yes. And as I mentioned, some that space in the basement that became vacant that we'll take over does allow us to move and reconfigure things upstairs to have the courtroom with the three adjoining offices for the law clerk, the judicial assistant, and the judge in court sit separately. Yes, that part of our plan is to ensure that this position would be accommodated in the courthouse.
Thank you, Chair. Practice for House Finance.
I understand.
Yeah.
I have a question. So I know that there's a ton of cases. Is there anything else happening in the Palmer Courthouse that slows down cases?
The things I mentioned, like the self-represented people, the especially in domestic relations cases, the complexity of cases, a lot of that is also true of other courthouses. In Palmer in particular, there seems to be anecdotally issues with the attorneys being a little less collegial than they were in 2007 when we got new judges. And people then used to work things out outside the courtroom or be able to stipulate to matters and come to agreement without involving a judge. And over the last 20 years, things in that regard have changed. And again, anecdotally, it seems that in that region, the attorneys are not always able to reach settlements or agreements without judicial intervention, and whereas in other courts they might be able to. That's not data. That is just one of the things that I've heard.
Thank you. Any other questions from committee members at this time?
I just have a statement.
Sure.
I just, I hope that the Finance Committee does take a hard look at this and prioritize, because we've had the conversations so many times about what justice looks like, and we have a constitutional mandate. And I think that's been one of our concerns for a very long time. And it was a number of years ago that increased pay in the courts, and, so many people are feeling like we don't give as much attention to the issue of justice in the courts. And so this one to me seems like a no-brainer that we have to figure out the fiscal, and that means we're going to have to prioritize. But this one seems pretty clear-cut because of all the pressures of this region on the courts. And just looking at these number of cases is mind-boggling to me. And like you said, the domino effect, and seeing that in the budget, when we're impacting so many lives with this, it seems straightforward. So I hope that finance members are listening and will see this as something that we can't delay on anymore.
you know, I was going to ask you, why wait so long to make this request? But you answered it by capacity. And I'm hoping that we can get things going on the court building as well, because that's just a practical thing. So thank you for figuring out all the puzzle pieces to make it work in the meantime. But I think this is one of those things that needs to go to the top of the budget pile, if you will, because it's a matter of justice for Alaskans.
Thank you, Representative Vance. Representative Kopp?
Yeah, I just wanted to highlight that the judge is rarely the problem with the backlog. They're very hardworking and they're mm-hmm. prodigious. We don't need to message to House Finance, respectfully, Representative Vance, to pay attention to this. What we have is all the support system that makes the justice system work, the prosecutors, the public defenders, the support staff, and they're hurting. And we have to address that employee issue, too. The judges are doing a great job. But to make that whole system work, you've got to have the public defenders and you have to have the prosecutors. And that's where we have to not drop the ball. What are we doing to make sure we're filling those positions? Just want to get that out there. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Representative Cobb. Representative Underwood.
Well, I'll just speak. Thank you, Chair Gray. Through the chair to Ms. Mead, thank you for this. Just as a representative for the Matanuska, Susitna Valley, a lot of these are my constituents and friends and family, and I have a lot of friends that work in this arena. And so I've heard the stress and delayed justice for no, like you're saying, for no lack of not wanting to. It's just the need is there. It's great. I so wish that we could have gotten that capital project in for the expansion. But just as a representative from out there, I know personally the wait times and how stressful it is for a myriad of people out there. So appreciate this. And I do hope that it gets attention to it and we can remedy it for now and then hopefully remedy it in the future so we don't have to come back to this. Thank you.
Seeing no more questions from committee, we will now take up public testimony. Public testimony on House Bill 262 is now open. Is there anyone in the room that would like to testify on House Bill 262? Seeing no one in the room, we'll look online. No one online. At this time, testimony on House Bill 262 is now closed. I would now like to set an amendment deadline on House Bill 262 for Thursday, February 5th. That's tomorrow. 2026 at 5 p.m. Please work with my committee aide to ensure that amendments are submitted on time. We will now set this bill aside until Friday. Our third, thank you so much, Ms. Mead. Our third item of business is to bring back House Bill 20, prohibit fees for paper documents. This is our second hearing on this item. I would like to invite the sponsor, Representative Sadler, and his staff to the table. I will start by saying that an amendment deadline was set and we received one amendment. We received that amendment from Representative Gray. At this time, I move amendment one.
I'll object for purposes of the discussion.
Amendment number one sets an effective date of January 1st, 2027. Rep. Sadler, as the bill sponsor, do you have any comment on amendment number one?
Mr. Chairman, thank you for the record. Representative Dan Sadler, District 24. No, I think it's a great amendment. It was properly offered, properly accepted, and I have no objection and would consider it a friendly amendment.
Thank you, Representative Sadler. Representative Kopp, do you maintain your objection?
I do not.
Seeing no further objections, Amendment 1 has been adopted. Are there any final comments about House Bill 20, Representative Sadler? And I'll also note that Heather Carpenter, the Director of Insurance, is in the room and available to answer any questions if needed. Representative Sadler, do you have any final comments?
Mr. Chairman, I do not, other than express my appreciation to the prompt and respectful reception of the bill and the spirit of discussion. I look forward to the committee's decision and further progress. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Do committee members have any questions for the sponsor or for Director Carpenter? Seeing no further comments or questions, do we have a motion at this time? Okay.
Mr. Chair, at this time, I move that House Bill 20, Work Order 34-LS0237/N, as amended, be reported out of the Judiciary Committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note.
Zero.
Hearing no objection, House Bill 20, Work Order 34-LS0237/N, as amended, is reported out of Judiciary Committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note. I also give Ledge legal authority to make any conforming changes as needed. We're going to sign the paperwork after we conclude today's meeting. Thank you so much, Representative Sadler and staff. That concludes today's business. Before we adjourn, here's a preview of our next meeting on Friday. We will take up House Bill 81, House Bill 4, and House Bill 262 for their second hearings. So that would be marijuana conviction records, presidential write-in, and additional Superior Court judge. The time is now 1:58 p.m., and this hearing of the House Judiciary Committee is adjourned.